Welcome to Optimizing, the podcast about leading Africa's digital future. I'm Professor Barry Dwolanski.
And I'm Karen Gammy.
Season 2 has the theme, Receiving and Passing the Baton. We're in conversation with people who have shaped or will shape Africa's digital future. Each conversation draws on the metaphor of life as a relay race. Our guests will talk about how they received the baton, who and what influenced them as they started life's journey. We will then discuss their own journey, how they nurtured and grew the baton in their hands. Finally, we will ask them about what it is that they will pass on to the next generation of leaders and experts. Today we are speaking to Chalitzi Marwala. Chalitzi is a South African engineer and computer scientist. In 1989, in his matric year, Chalitzi won the National Youth Science Olympiad, and he had the opportunity to attend the London International Youth Science Fortnight. And I'm sure that opened up the world for him. In an instant, this young man from a rural village in the northern part of South Africa, Venda, became a player on the world stage. He went on to study mechanical engineering at Case Western University in Cleveland, Ohio, in the USA. And dare I need to say, he completed that magna cum laude, which means he did really, really well. He then returned to South Africa to do his master's, which he did at the University of Pretoria. He then went on to Cambridge University for his PhD in AI, and he followed that up with a period of postdoctoral research at Imperial College in London. He then came back to South Africa, and he worked at the CSIR and South African Breweries before he joined Wits as a professor in the School of Electrical and Information Engineering, where him and I became colleagues. From Wits, he went to UJ, where he rapidly climbed the ranks of academic leadership, and he moved from being Dean of Engineering to the Deputy Vice-Chancellor for Research to his current position as the Principal and Vice-Chancellor of the University of Johannesburg. Chalitzi has received many awards and many honors, including the Mapungubwe Award, which in my mind is a South African knighthood. So if he were in Britain, we would be calling him Professor Sir Chalitzi Marwala. But he has really been broadly recognized by his peers and by leadership in our country and abroad. He is known for his pioneering research in the field of AI, which is applied to many interesting applications from brewing beer to conflict resolution. He's also the deputy chair of the Presidential Commission on the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So to frame this conversation, and before we start speaking to Chalitzi and Kieran, I would like to pose a metaphor, and the metaphor is that life is a relay race, and when we're young, we are handed a baton by those who have gone before us. We receive it from our parents, our teachers, our mentors, and elders. Chalitzi, in this conversation, we will be asking you about the one or more batons that you have received from those who went before you. We'll then ask you to reflect on how you have made these batons better and made them your own. And finally, we would like you to imagine handing it over to those who come next. What is it that you will hand over? I'm joined in this conversation by my co-host, Karen Gammy. Karen started quite recently on her journey. She works developing data science and artificial intelligence systems, and it is her and her generation of future leaders and future experts who will be receiving the wisdom and the baton that Chalitzi passes on. So after that very long introduction, Chalitzi, in many ways, you have had a remarkable life and you've been on a remarkable journey. And it's interesting, and in fact, the most remarkable thing is about how your journey started, how you received this this baton. Clearly, you were and are a very special person with great gifts and talents. However, in our country then and even now, there are many exceptional young people, and very few of them grow up to be as accomplished as you are. Can you talk a bit about the young Chalitzi, your family, your school, your teachers, and the people who influenced and inspired you in those very early days and made it possible for you to start on this amazing trajectory?
Thank you very much, Barry and Kevin. I was born in the part of South Africa called Venda. It is in the northern part of this country. And I think one thing that I really appreciated about growing up in that part of the world was the education that I got from my community. I was very close to my grandmother. My paternal grandmother was a very inspiring a woman who never really went to school, but she understood the value of education. She was a very curious woman. In fact, I always say that my first engineering teacher was my grandmother. She used to make clay pots, and I would go with her to the river to collect clay. And of course, in engineering, we call that material selection, and she would come back and form it into a pot without any using any complicated 3D AutoCAD softwares to be able to make the shape perfect, and then she will put it in the sun, and then she will put it in the furnace, and allow it to cool very, very slowly. And of course, that whole idea of cooling pots very slowly is very similar to the engineering concept of annealing. In fact, in AI, we have an algorithm, an optimization algorithm called simulated annealing that came out of that. So I think my grandmother was perhaps a very influential person in my life. My parents also loved education. My father was a math teacher. At an earlier age, I was curious to see what was inside those mathematical textbooks, and I sort of can recall the evolution of the complexity of my understanding of mathematics. Initially, I thought everything was linear, that you could be able to predict things by following the linear relationships. And of course, later on, when I learned about logarithms, I realized that things are not as linear. So, and then I went to high school in Trando, a high school called Mbiri. Mbiri is actually quite a special school. It was a government school, but actually quite special. I always say that in my own class, which was not a very, very big a class, maybe a class of 100 people, we produced an MIT researcher. We produced the editor of City Press. We produced one of the CEOs of Daimler. And I think, I was motivated by that. You know, it was special in the sense that everybody was motivated. But certainly, it is important as we structure our education system to make sure that we are able to motivate our young people. I was motivated by the classroom that I was in, by the people whom I was interacting with, and so on and so forth. And then finally, when I was finishing matric, I won the Science Olympiad. Last year, I went to my high school, and I met the principal of the high school. And we went to assembly, and when I was telling the students that that principal was actually my biology teacher, they couldn't believe. They thought I was older than him. But he took me to an old diary entry at a point where the day it was announced that I won the Science Olympiad. It was quite exciting because I hardly knew Johannesburg, and I had to go to London. I went to Imperial College, was the host of the Science Fortnight. And Barry, you were at Imperial College at the time, at the time, you know, but our path did not cross. Obviously, it was an eye-opening. I was in the same room with people from East Germany and West Germany representing two different countries literally weeks before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So it was actually quite a defining moment for me. We also saw the emergence of China at that point. Because what was happening at that point was that China was just opening up. It was 10 years after the opening up. So the young students from China were very, very curious. You could see that these are young people with a mission. And of course, as they say, the rest is history. But when I was attending the Science Week, we were taught about all sorts of things. I can't remember being taught about artificial intelligence. All I remember was that everybody was talking about this new technology that is going to revolutionize the world. And this technology was superconductivity. And of course, as they say, superconductivity never became the big technology it was supposed to be. So all that experience actually shaped my future career. And when I arrived in England at that point, I wanted to be a doctor. But after that, I decided that I was going to be an engineer. And I also decided that I'm going to study overseas. And then obviously because of that, I came back, I finished matric. I did quite well. I appeared in newspapers as one of the students who have done well. And then I went to do A levels to prepare for myself to go and study overseas. So I came and lived in Johannesburg for the first time. I lived in Houghton. I was at St. John's College here in Houghton doing A levels. And after that, I went to University of Cape Town for 6 months while I was waiting for the academic calendar in North America to open. Of course, I was not really sure whether I was gonna leave because I was told about the scholarship around about March, and it took me quite a while to decide whether I should go to North America.
Could I step in here? And I mean, it's such an interesting and inspirational story, and you did something quite unusual for South Africans generally. And that is to do your first degree overseas. And you went, as we've said, to the States. You went to a very good university in the States. But could you speak about your choice of going overseas to do your undergrad? Why did you make that choice rather than doing your first degree in South Africa?
Well, I really enjoyed my time in England. I absolutely enjoyed visiting University of Cambridge and Oxford. They made us visit those two institutions, and I enjoyed being at Imperial College next to the Science Museum. So when I came back from England, my mind was more or less set about wanting to study overseas. The options at that point that were available to study overseas was England, Canada, or United States. Then I went and watched a show called L.A. Law. I don't know whether you still remember that.
Very well. And that inspired you.
And the accent was just something that I never really had never actually encountered, you know. We take it for granted that, you know, if you were growing up in the 80s, you know, you did not see the world as much as people today do. You know, if you were growing up in Venda, you know, there was not even in television. Certainly we did not have television in our home. So it was actually quite spectacular. And the Americans who were attending the Science Forum, I would say they were, now I would say they are showmen, because I've spent time in America. It's a very extrovert culture, you know. It was impressive when you're sitting, you're coming from South Africa, you see these young people, they are very loud, and they actually speak their minds, you know. So that is really the reason that made me choose to go to North America. And obviously when I arrived in Ohio, it was actually a bit of a shock. There were only 3 South Africans at the university. One of them was quite coincidentally from my high school in Venda.
That's amazing.
A gentleman called Joseph Makari. He's one. There is a casino in Polokwane. He is one of the owners of that casino. And then there was Enos Banda, who later became the CEO of Eskom Enterprise. So it was and lots of Asians, because it was a period in which the Asian Tigers were sending lots of students to study in North America. So lots of students from Malaysia. I had many friends. One of my best friends was actually from Tokyo. So it was a life altering experience. And the second thing that I really would like to put forward, when I transferred from UCT, I understood how the engineering curriculum, mechanical engineering curriculum at UCT looks like. And then I arrived in North America, and things were not quite the same as what I saw in the curriculum at UCT. Of course, you will have common courses such as calculus. Here in South Africa, we call it mathematics, but it's basically the same. The big difference was that I was all of a sudden expected to take 12 semesters of human and social sciences as part of my curriculum. That was a big difference. You know, and now I understand the value of studying psychology. You know, when we talk about reinforcement learning in artificial intelligence, I always say that the first time I heard about reinforcement learning was actually in a psychology class. You know, so my understanding of reinforcement learning actually starts with the biological sciences. Pavlov and his dogs, and how he came up with the theory of motivation, and ultimately you motivate people through the concept of reward and punishment. So that was actually quite something that I absolutely enjoyed.
Because in fact, quite interesting that Karen, my co-presenter, did her degree in Cape Town, also at UCT, and she did philosophy, and she's gone into artificial intelligence. And I don't know, Karen, if you want to talk about your transition from humanities into AI.
Yes. Hi. Firstly, hi, Prof. It's really cool to have you on this podcast. I've seen a couple of your talks. It's always really, really cool. So this is super dope. I'm excited. So yeah, as Prof. Dolatsky said, Yeah, I did my background in humanities at UCT, specifically philosophy and economics, and then I was sort of doing an internship at this fintech, and you got to rotate around the different departments, and there was this department called data science, and I was like, wow, I have no clue what these guys do, but they all seem really cool, so let me give it a shot. And I felt like in the first like week and a half, I was like, oh my goodness, this is basically philosophy, except like you don't just have to think in abstraction, you can actually like have a meaningful kind of output in the form of code or whatever. And I was like, that's super, super cool. And then, yeah, I kind of got interested in credit risk as well. And I think, you know, AI really thrives in optimizing sort of problem statements. And I think credit risk has a lot of that. So it was pretty easy to marry the two kind of disciplines. But one thing that I got more and more interested in is, like, you know, credit is something that I think holds a lot of weight in South Africa, as probably in most countries. But there's such a kind of tenuous relationship with it, and it means that you have to be really careful about the models that you design, even if they're super sophisticated and algorithmically enticing. There's an ethical impact to that. And I think that as well kind of really helped me sort of combine the two disciplines of, like, you know, AI and philosophy, which has probably more overlaps than we think. So yeah, hearing you talk about kind of your own journey with a really technical degree and then also like social sciences is brilliant, and that's super exciting.
And we will talk slightly more a bit later about this relationship between AI and humanities and the things Chalitzi has done. Kind of just tie up your very early career, Chalitzi, you spent some time in the in a top university in the US, and unfortunately a lot of South Africans who go that way tend not to come back. So we tend to find our sort of brightest and best people, or some of them, who go to the US or go to Europe or go abroad and study, and they're enticed to stay in the country they study in. It's quite interesting that you came back, and you came back to do your master's. Could you just talk about what motivated you to come back rather than to carry on your academic career in the US or elsewhere?
But yeah, good. It was not as straightforward as that. I must confess, there were pull factors. I spent a lot of time thinking about when will there be the right time to come to South Africa. I went and spent a little bit of time in Canada, Edmonton. It was not very exciting, so I dismissed that right away. And then when I was in London, I have mixed feelings about London. When I was staying in London, it was very expensive. I suppose Imperial College is not is probably not the right place to be from a cost benefit perspective. It is in Zone 1, very, very expensive part of London, which basically means you live very far from where you work. I was living in Battersea. There was no underground. I could use a bus, but a bus used to take almost an hour. I could walk in just a little bit less than an hour. So that was one of the issues that I considered before I came back. And secondly, I always wanted to come back and contribute to education in South Africa. And I did not want to go and work for a company. The fact that I went to South African Breweries is actually quite coincidental. I was supposed to have landed at the University of Pretoria, and in the last minute, I sort of felt that maybe I should just go and see how the so-called real world looks like, and basically, I realized that in South Africa, there was a great deal to be done. And ultimately, when I came to Wits University, I really absolutely enjoyed myself working there. The students that I have worked with have inspired me quite a great deal.
It's kind of important as well, and I'm trying to sort of unpick a bit about what influences people and influenced you to make decisions. So through the time that you were growing up and when you returned to South Africa, politics were a very important factor in our country. And strangely, at that time, although politics was so important, many scientists and engineers that I've met and that I kind of met then didn't seem to have much interest in political and social issues. But you were clearly not one of those. You were inspired and you kind of looked at the political and social. And in terms of who influenced you, who were your influences to kind of make you unlike other engineers and scientists? Was it the fact that you did humanities courses in the States, or were there other forces in your life that made you become a sort of political and social animal and not just an engineer and scientist?
I think it's a combination of a number of things. Firstly, I was genuinely quite curious. I really was genuinely quite curious. And I went and took, now when I think about it, I was quite ambitious in the sort of courses that I took. I took all my summer classes. It's only one summer that I did not take any classes. So I ended up having, I was supposed to graduate with 131 credits. And I think I ended up graduating with 161 credits. And some of the courses that I took, for example, I thought I took two acting classes. When I went to my transcript, I realized that I actually took three acting classes. I took two psychology classes. I took two history classes, history of South Africa, and history and philosophy of science. Quite coincidentally, I am reading a book that I read as an undergraduate student right now. You know, The Structure of Scientific Revolution by Thomas Kuhn. There was a prescribed book there. And I ended up taking economics as my minor. I took seven economic classes. And I think the diversity of courses that I took would have contributed to my liking of complex problems. And many of the complex problems, I see them in human and social sciences. Because precision is not quite there, you know. You don't measure behavior. You know, it's not as easy to measure behavior as compared to measuring the vibration of a structure, for example. So that did actually influence me. And then also the people around me actually influenced me. For example, my love for history was because you know, one of my neighbors used to ask me to work with him, and he's going to be explaining to me about history. You know, not too long ago, I hosted a gentleman called Dr. Mukwebo here at the University of Johannesburg. And I was reminding him that when I was still a young man, I must have been 12, 13, he's older than me, that he read Julius Caesar for me and my friend over, I think, five sessions. You know, it was done on Sunday, so I'll go on Sunday and we'll read part, and then we go and complete it. And I think the combination of what happened in the classroom and what happened in the outside the classroom actually motivated me to be interested in the world in its totality.
I think that's a very critical thing. And when we speak later about passing on the baton, I can see that there are things there that are the kind of inspirations young people should hear in terms of broadening their knowledge and broadening their worldview. To talk a bit about your race, so in this metaphor of the relay race, we've spoken about receiving the baton, and then you ran your race. And so you've got your baton in your hand, and you're racing off on life's journey, and you quickly are making this baton your own. Can you talk a bit about your formative research years, the kind of things you did for your master's and PhD? What research were you doing when you were doing your master's and PhD?
So when I was doing my master's, I did my master's in finite element modeling. So finite element is a numerical technique that is used to model things as complex as a structure of a building, movement of gas, and you can even use it to numerically solve the Navier-Stokes equation. Or even the Black-Scholes equations in finance, you know. So my task there was to reconcile what the mathematical model was predicting with what the measurements were seeing. So you, on one hand, you have measurements. On the other hand, you have prediction from a mathematical computer software model. And the task is really to bring the model, because you can't move the data. The data is the reality. The only thing you can move there is the model. How do you move the model closer to the reality to make it more correct or more true? I wouldn't want to use loaded words like truth in this regard, you know, because these are ultimately approximations. And then, obviously, naturally, it takes you to the world of optimization, because the way you tackle this problem, you make the things you are not sure about, the variables you are not sure about, subjects to an optimization process, and the objective of that optimization process is to bring your mathematical model to your experimental data. And then when I went to do a PhD, now artificial intelligence, quite coincidentally, is also about that. You have a mathematical model on one hand, and you have your observation, which is your data. And what you want to do is to make your mathematical model reflect the distribution of your data as much as possible. So again, that is why when you do artificial intelligence, just like when I was doing model updating in finite element analysis, the common thread there is some optimization process. In fact, we use the same optimization process, whether it is gradient descent, whether it's conjugate gradient method, all these things are actually quite common. The only difference there is that in finite element model, you can claim that the models are physically realistic because you use Newton's laws of motion to actually derive the mathematical model, whereas in a deep learning architecture, it is a statistical model that is not derived from any form of reality. It works. It can be able to predict the data. So this is how I actually ended up in AI. And then when I came to do a postdoc at Imperial College, we were working on how do we make software agents intelligent and adaptive. At that point, they did not want us to use the word software agent. I met Philippe, my postdoctoral supervisor, and I was reminding him that The European Union used to be very angry if we use the word agent. And the reason why they did not want to use the word agent was because the Americans were using the word agent, and they invented their own word called info-habitat. You know, you can see it was not a psychologist who came up with the word info-habitat. So it's even difficult to pronounce it. And if something is difficult to pronounce it, then it's not going to be used. You know, I went and searched for the word info-habitat on the internet, and I can see my writings. It looks like it never got any legs. It never went anywhere. So that is really my research career. Yeah. So that is how I came to the field of artificial intelligence.
And in fact, very interestingly, my time at Imperial College, which sort of overlapped with you being there as this young post-matriculant visiting London for the first time, and it was towards the end of my time in the UK. But the program I was working on at Imperial was called the Prope Group, and we were looking at applying optimal control theory to the world of macroeconomic policy formulation. And we used these big macroeconomic models. And the interesting thing about those models is that they couldn't model human behavior, because humans obviously are kind of watching the policies and changing their behavior to beat the control. So the control system is always fighting the model. And it was a very interesting case. And we looked at some of the game theory ideas in terms of not just applying control theory, but looking at competitive games. So there were some obvious overlaps there. Karen, what would you, in terms of hearing Chalitzi's research background and the things he's been talking about, and looking at your career as it now formulates, what would you kind of think about the comparisons, and have you got anything to say?
Yeah, so thank you. I've kind of just had my like jaw on the floor just listening to sort of the research and the things that you were interested in. And I guess it's interesting to me that you did your master's in sort of the finite element modeling and stuff, which is a really, really like deeply technical kind of technique in structural mechanics or whatever, and yet you had like this very clear curiosity towards, you know, the social side of things. And so I'm wondering kind of, especially now that I think the AI community is trying to be more intentional about ethics and the stuff that gets built and scaled, I'm kind of wondering a little bit like what your social side of AI was like while you were doing this research.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that I really enjoyed working in AI was maybe just before I talk about that, one of the principles that I adopted earlier on was the principle of open-mindedness. That when a student comes and they say they want to work in this area, I should be open-minded about it, you know. As long as it has academic merit. So as a result, and I have supervised, I was actually just counting, I have supervised 30 PhDs and 50 master's students to completion, which is actually quite a huge number, you know.
Yeah, that is very impressive.
And many of it actually is advanced university. And the span of the work, I mean, economics is quite natural because I took 7 economic classes when I was an undergraduate. So I know enough, certainly enough basic economics to be able to work quite attentively on. So I've spent a lot of time working in economics. 2 years back, I wrote a book, I co-wrote it with my student who was my master student at Vest. I'm not too sure whether Bill, you still remember a gentleman called Evan Hewitt.
Yes, very, very well.
He did a master's with me at Vets on teaching a computer to learn how to bluff. You know, you have to be open-minded to work on a topic like that. And then when I moved to University of Johannesburg, he followed to come and do a PhD, which he completed it in portfolio theory. You know, which is really more finance. Markowitz won a Nobel Prize for that. And last year, not last year, about 4 years ago, we were worried about the whole discipline of economics. That economics, as we study it at school, is constructed under the assumption that the agent for decision making is a human being. Whereas what is actually happening is that the agent is no longer a human being. It's at best a combination of a human being and a machine. And we are saying, what does this thing actually do to the whole field of economics? And we took about 15 subjects, many of them that won a Nobel Prize. For example, demand and supply. What happens to that demand and supply curve that we are taught when we get into economics? And the answer is very simple. It is being aggregated because when you go to pick and pay, you are subjected to a price that was arrived from aggregate demand and aggregate supply. You know, whereas if you go to an Amazon platform, you know, you are subjected to your own, maybe aggregate supply, but certainly the demand is your own individual demand curve. And that is why for the same product, people pay different prices. So you have the individualization of the demand curve and ultimately of price. You know, and then you can go on to mechanism design, you can go on to rationality, and so on and so forth. And then the other area that I got into, I was introduced to this area by Monica Lagaccio. She is a political scientist from Lecce in Italy. And she said, you know, can we use AI to be able to make interstate conflict predictions? And we did this, you know. And we wrote a book which... we still don't know why, but the Chinese military academy actually translated it into Mandarin. I often wonder how they reformulate words in the manuscript about democracy. It will be very interesting to know how they reformulate it so that the people in China are able to understand. As you know, their political system is quite different. So basically, the areas which I really have worked on are areas that I've been passionate about. So I became passionate about big issues of conflict. I spent a lot of time working with David Rubin, who introduced me to biomedical engineering. So I would have spent a lot of time applying AI to designing artificial larynx, or in prediction of pulmonary embolism, and so on and so forth. So it was also open mindedness when students come, open mindedness in collaborating with people you wouldn't traditionally collaborate with because they are almost from a separate discipline than yours. And I think my very multidisciplinary undergraduate training had a huge contribution towards that mindset.
So that's really fascinating, and that leads us to the next thing that I wanted to discuss, and it's really pretty nearly bringing us up to where you are now. And you are currently the deputy chair of the Presidential Commission on the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And in the past couple of years, you've become best known for your engagement around the conversations around 4IR. And you, a couple of months ago, published some of the findings that the commission has come up with. And for those of the listeners that haven't really heard what the commission is proposing, could you just maybe speak about some of the things that you are recommending to the president in terms of preparing for the Fourth Industrial Revolution?
No thanks. I think this the issue of the Fourth Industrial Revolution is obviously something that I've become very interested in over the last few years. And of course, artificial intelligence is at the heart of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So we as the commission, when we came together to come up with the recommendations, I was actually I had the intention that we shouldn't give 1,000 recommendations. You know, there has to be maybe 5 or originally I wanted it to be 5. Ultimately, it became 8 core recommendations. Of course, there are many recommendations under each recommendation, and there are other recommendations that wouldn't necessarily fit into one recommendation. But the first recommendation was about investing in human capacity in the areas of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And for me, instead of going to point at a particular subject that people need to study. Some people say you need to recommend that our schooling must teach people how to code. I wanted to focus on the core skills that you would need in order to be able to master these technologies and the development around the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Computational thinking, for example, you know, ability to think logically. Especially given the fact that in the schooling system, we do not have a single subject that you can call logic, you know, that teaches you to think logically directly. Of course, it comes indirectly through the study of mathematics and so on and so forth. Multidisciplinarity is actually very, very important in higher education for our people to be able to master the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Because, for example, if somebody is going to work on an algorithm that is going to translate a spoken word from one language to another, it goes without saying that such a person must understand how to code. But at the same time, such person must also be able to understand linguistics. And in South Africa, you will be hard-pressed to find somebody who is studying computer science and linguistics. But those two things are becoming much, much closer. You know, the 4IR, the artificial intelligence, these are multidisciplinary subjects. So the skills must also reflect that. So the first recommendation is around human capacity development. The second recommendation is about National Artificial Intelligence Institute that focuses on application of AI in all areas of our economy and our society. And then the third recommendation is around creating a platform for advanced manufacturing through the adoption of the technologies of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, whether it is 3D printing, whether it is artificial intelligence, Internet of Things. How do we bring those things into our manufacturing domain to increase productivity of our of our industrial base. Then the fourth recommendation is around data. And there we say, avail and secure data in order to promote the commerce of the fourth industrial revolution. So what we are saying here is that data must be available whenever it is possible. It should be open and available, so that a small enterprise in AI can be able to go into our medical database, which is obviously, it has to be secure in the sense that it does not reveal people's identity, and they can be able to create an app that will be able to get an image of an X-ray and be able to diagnose you know, whether somebody has pulmonary embolism or not, for the doctor to be able to you know, to have a much more reliable device doing that, you know. And then the fifth recommendation is around incentivizing the adoption of these technologies. I think one of the American economists, I can't remember, I think it is Robert Shiller, who was once asked, could you explain the whole of economics in one word? And his answer was incentives. Because if you have incentives, you'll have demand and supply. And you'll have almost every important aspect of economics. So even here we're saying that these technologies will not be adopted as effectively as we would like them to be adopted. And what we ought to do is to incentivize. Tax incentives? Is it access to research support? Access to grants through the Technology Innovation Agency? Whatever the incentives are, but it is clear that we need to incentivize people to adopt these technologies. Then the sixth recommendation is around investing in 4IR infrastructure. One of the things that we need to do right away is the issue of spectrum. You know, it should be competitive. And then the seventh recommendation is around amending legislation so that it is in line with the development in the digital economy. One example, ICASA. When we had a telegram, there was a regulator of a telegram. When the telegram disappeared, that regulator disappeared. Then we have ICASA that was regulating broadcasting and so on and so forth. You know, that era is coming to an end. The things that we would normally get through broadcasting now, we are now getting it through the digital platform, which is not regulated. You know, and so on and so forth. So ICASA must actually come to the digital age. We need to start thinking, you know, I was looking at, I think it's Estonia. They now have what is called digital residency. Now you get residency in order to be able to work and live in a particular area. But people do not necessarily live in places where they work. You know, a lot of work in Silicon Valley is being done in India, you know. So in many ways, or it is outsourcing, but the other way of doing it is to give such people digital residency so that they are able to work through the cloud, obviously, in Silicon Valley. And then the last recommendation is around implementation. And on implementation, the role of non-state actors cannot be emphasized enough. Because in South Africa, like in many other parts of the world, there is more knowledge about the technologies of the fourth industrial revolution in private hands than in public hands. So it goes without saying that if you expect the public sector to be able to carry any of these recommendations, it is going to fail. It will only succeed if the role of private actors is actually elevated. In fact, it is elevated higher than the role of the public sector. And my views is that the public sector must set the scene, must create the environment, and then the private sector must do the work.
Thank you. It's an amazing a collection of coherent and integrated proposals, and they all hang together. I have to ask, and it's bringing us right up to today. So does the experience of the COVID pandemic, and people are saying that due to the pandemic, digital transformation has been accelerated, and a lot of the intentions or the expectations around 4IR are now being activated through COVID. But in terms of what we're seeing around COVID, would you say any of the recommendations of the commission which reported prior to the pandemic would change? Has there been any new thinking around where we should be going in the post-COVID world?
No, absolutely. I think the post-COVID world is going to be very digital. And naturally, if it is going to be digital, our recommendation around data is going to become very, very important. One of the things that we talk about in the recommendation around data, we talk about data storage and the need to have, we put it up front that don't build data centers, go and buy clouds, cloud computing, another issue, edge computing, very, very important, given the fact that here at University of Johannesburg, we are using a system called Blackboard, and that system is not is from the cloud. It's operating from the cloud, and it will actually be very. It will make our work much more efficient if it was located closer to us. Edge computing becomes very, very important. So the issue around data talks is at the core of the post-COVID world. How do you manage data? The issue around 4IR infrastructure is also another issue that is at the core of the post-COVID world, because it talks of issues of connectivity. It talks of issues of the speed of connectivity. It talks of issues of devices of connectivity. So very, very important. The issue of legislation, flexible legislation, becomes very, very important. One of the things that happened during COVID that people do not know is that there was an emergency spectrum allocation to allow our telecommunication companies to be able to support the sudden surge in the utilization of data. Very, very important. So the issue of flexible regime to be able to meet the needs depending on what it is very, very important. The issue of AI being at the center of the solutions, what I read from China is it takes it to another level, whereby they are using AI-enabled drones to monitor movements of people, and some of those drones they talk to people if they are not wearing their masks. The issue of using home robots to clean to maximize social distancing. If you remove the movement of people up and down, unnecessary movement of people up and down, then you're going to deal with issues of COVID. So I'm quite confident that these recommendations that we have put are almost in line and they address the demands of the post-COVID world.
That's fantastic. And, I think that you've touched on something that really speaks a lot to 4IR. And I know Karen is very interested, and she mentioned a bit about it, but the question of the link between sort of ethics and control and state monitoring and moving into this AI robot controlled world. Karen, would you like to talk a bit about sort of the kind of ethics around AI in this COVID world where monitoring is being done and things like that?
Yeah, thank you so much. So this is honestly a topic I could go on for hours and hours about. But yeah, I guess, you know, recently and not necessarily specific to COVID, but I think it's catalyzed a lot of things. It's become very clear that, you know, even when we kind of privatize information or have private companies taking over a certain kind of social problems, there's a bit of a disconnect in terms of who is solving for these problems and the fact that the who's are often not part of the problems themselves. So it can become a somewhat sort of superficial problem-solving exercise. And, you know, you've obviously spoken about this earlier around kind of the need for that kind of interdisciplinary thing. And so I'm curious to understand kind of like, you know, more pragmatically outside of, you know, hiring people who are linguists and upskilling them in Python or whatever. What do you think South Africa needs to do in terms of like making AI more ethical and not just, you know, scalable?
No, I mean, just coincidentally, I am in a team of the World Health Organization that is developing ethical guidelines for the applications of AI in medicine. The problem with that whole issue of ethics of AI is the complexity of the problem. Because, for example, let us just take an instance whereby an AI algorithm is being used in a hospital. The value chain of that whole process, it starts with the collection of data and the ethics of the collection of data. You know, then that data has to be used to train an algorithm. There has to be some governance around that. And there's no standardization. It's not like we have not reached a point in a country where they will tell you that if you want to design a bridge, these are the guidelines that you need to follow, and if you don't follow them, then you are outside the ethical guidelines, because you will be putting people in danger. We have not reached that point, and then at the end you have the user, in this instance is a doctor, you know. So when something goes wrong, you don't really know where the source of the problem is. It's not clear where the source of the problem is. And the identification of the source of problem, in many ways, is an inverse problem, which basically means it is not unique. It has multiple solutions, and you will not know which solution is which. Just a few weeks back, I think 2 weeks back, I wrote an article on Sunday Times about the use of AI to deal with the issue of corruption. And one of my academics, Professor Jane Duncan, responded in last Sunday to my article, basically saying that getting AI to become a judge in a court of law is a step too far, because AI can be biased, you know. And then and what we don't understand, what we need to start taking into account, is that the human judges are actually also biased. I read a study, I think it was in Israel, where they were saying that Judges are much harsher after lunch than before lunch. And the explanation is probably because they are hungry or they are in a rush to go and eat and so on and so forth. You know. So, the ethics of AI are similar, maybe a little bit more complicated than the ethics of human beings. The good thing is that I think the ethics of AI is easier to fix than ethics of human beings. We know that algorithms discriminate because their data is not representative enough. And we can be able to make sure that before we deploy an AI system, it has to be able to meet the representativity criteria. You know, but so you can fix it. But if it was a human being, you wouldn't be able to fix it. You know. So, and then lastly, we need to invest in the skills of people who study the ethics of AI. It's not clear, if you look at the grants that are going to AI, and you look at the proportion of grants that go to the ethical part of AI, as compared to the grants that go to the commercial aspect of AI, you can't even compare the two. And secondly, we need to assemble the people. They are obviously going to have to be multidisciplinary. Ideally, you want somebody who understands ethics in its traditional form, but also at the same time understands technology. And that does not come easy. What it means as educators, we need to start creating new types of areas of specialization. Here at the University of Johannesburg, I know, Barry, your son studied a course called PPE, Politics, Philosophy, and Economics. And when I went to, I was speaking at the Cambridge, Oxford Union last year on the ethics of AI, quite coincidentally. And it got to my mind that PPE is an excellent qualification. But now maybe you need a PET, Politics, Economics, and Technology. Technology now is so important in our lives that it has to be studied alongside philosophy and economics. You know, and once we start shifting towards infusing technology into whether it is PPE, whether it is law, then we shall actually be able to train enough people to be able to go and handle issues of ethics within the complexity of technology and its evolution.
That's really great. I mean, that's a great perception. We are coming to the end, and there are a few short questions that I have before we tie up. And one is just to talk about an African perspective. A digital transformation is important in South Africa, as it is across Africa. And what do you see as South Africa's role or place within the broader African perspective?
Well, there are a number of roles that Africa can play. When President Cyril Ramaphosa took over as the chairman of the African Union, one of his flagship projects was the establishment of the Africa AI Forum, where Africans are going to come together within a single platform or multiple platforms and start talking about AI and how we can shape it in order to work for Africa, its people, and its economies. very, very important. South Africa is the most industrialized country in the continent, and therefore you can't really talk about matters of technology without actually getting South Africa into the equation. Other countries are making quite huge progress. I spend quite a great deal of time in Rwanda, very, very impressed about that. I am a chairman of the Institute of Internet of Things at the University of Rwanda. I think it is a World Bank. It is a World Bank institute that deals with Internet of Things and how we can be able to exploit it. So we need to build institutes that will put us at the core of the digital transformation. Whether it is the National AI Institute or the continental one should also come. We need to train people to be able to understand these technologies. Again, education on technology is very important across the board. I spend quite a great deal of time. I'm a columnist in Forbes Africa, talking about technology and what it is doing to Africa. We need to understand how it is evolving. For example, if you go to Ghana now, you have lots of people who are doing AI. Many of them coming from the West, because Google has a $1 billion AI lab in Ghana. You know, we need to see what they are doing, how we can collaborate, and how we can diffuse what they are doing to the rest of the African continent. Microsoft is investing a similar platform in Nairobi. You know, so we need to understand what is going on and how we can be able to diffuse it to the rest of the African continent. We need to start engaging movement of people, because AI is about solving real world problems. And we are not going to solve real world problems unless we understand the African continent. One of the things that we have done here at the University of Johannesburg, we introduced something called Africa by Bus. Obviously, it stopped because of COVID, you know. And what we, it started as Africa by Bus and it became Innovation by Bus. We took our students to Mozambique. We took our students to Zambia by bus. We took them to Namibia. We took them to Botswana, and this year we're going to take them to Kigali and on the way to Kampala. And the idea is that there are lots of problems that are looking for solutions, for technological solutions. You need to understand these problems, and you can only understand them if you see things, you experience them, and you interact with people, and then we can be able to come up with solutions that we can scale and we can commercialize and we can be able to contribute to our economies.
Thank you. That's a wonderful answer, and it really gives a grand view of where your journey has taken you and your eminent position on the African continent in the broad field of AI. And then in your specializations. So, as we come to the last bit of the podcast, and this is to kind of note that, and I'm certainly not saying that your race is done, because you still have a lot of energy in you, I know that. But I'm supposing that I were to ask you to think about Karen and her generation here in South Africa, her generation across Africa, or her generation in the world. And if you were looking across the table at them and saying, here is my advice to you, here's what I hand over, here is the baton that I want to put in your hands, what would a few pointers, a few words of advice you would give to the next generation?
So I would say, Kevin, be involved. be involved in the AI community, for example. I know many people are quite active in the deep learning in Dava.
My favorite.
That is educating the people in the African continent. Excellent initiative. By the way, Berry, I don't know whether you know that the two people who came up with the idea of deep learning in Dava were master students at VETS, Shakir Muhammad, who went and did a PhD at Cambridge, and
this one of our ex-students.
Vukosi Malivate,
who is now at UP.
Who did a master's with me and went to Rutgers to do a PhD in AI. So be involved, very, very important. And secondly, be open-minded. The people who are actually going to come up with the solutions to many of the pressing problems in AI, in digitization, will be people who are coming from outside. It won't be the insiders who are almost conditioned to a paradigm. I can speak about the paradigm now that I'm just I just freshly read Thomas Kuhn. It's people who are going to ask the difficult questions from a different perspective than the convention, because what you see was built by the current paradigm, and maybe the solutions to our problems are going to require another paradigm. And then the third thing is that I would advise Kevin is reading. Don't forget to read. I read at least 3 books per month. I cheat a little bit because I listen to it while I'm walking in the morning. I do a one and a half hour
smart
walk every morning. So I'm listening to a book. Read and read widely. It's things that you would not have a direct connection to your work that might actually have the answers to your to the problems that you face in your work, in your career, and in your dreams. So thank you very much.
And thank you so much, Chilitsi, for those pearls of wisdom. And, if I just have to look at your life and look at what you've done, and it's been clear to me from the day I met you that you're a multidimensional human being, that you what we used to call a polymath. I don't know if they still use that wonderful word, but a person who really looks at the world from every angle. And you told me recently that you did acting classes. You mentioned it again. And it really fits, you kind of really step out of your box and do other things, and you carry on doing that. So thank you so much for being part of this conversation, and also thanks for joining us on the podcast and giving of your time. And please keep doing what you do, and we'll keep watching what you do, and hopefully have you back to tell us more exciting things that you've been doing.
No, thank you very much, Berry. Thank you very much, Kevin. And I look forward to engaging you again.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Is a Grand Geeks production. It is produced by Professor Barry Dwalatsky and edited by Evan Wigdorowitz. It is presented by Professor Barry Dwalatsky and Karen Gammy. Music is done by Callum Cool and logo designed by Evan Wigdorowitz. The companion website is at www.softwareengineer.org.za.